Well, good morning, folks. This is Jim the Keys Bartender coming to you from a beautiful Key Largo in the Florida Keys. The Keys Bartender podcast is a podcast about bartending and life here in the Keys. So I was thinking today, and I think about this every so often, that some drinks have a moment in time where they're very super popular. And I was having a discussion with some coworkers while we're doing our wine class. We're doing a we had a little class on the wines that they were going to be introducing to the new place I work at, the Crooked Palm Cabana in Tavernier. It's going to be opening next week, the 22nd, April the 22nd, Monday, the April 22nd. I just have to remember that. Well, when I was first bartending in, let's say, 82, 83, when I was in a sophomore in college, when I first introduced into it, there was different drinks that were popular in school and among the college crowd. And they were kind of iconic, if you think about it. They were drinks that were popular for like 30, 40 years. It was in the mid-80s, early to mid-80s, and they still had a highball, which was whiskey 7-Up and ginger ale. And then there was, gosh, the Collins, the Tom Collins, which is gin, and the Vodka Collins, which is obviously vodka. And then you had other drinks like the Sloe Gin Fizz. I think that's fallen by the wayside. That was popular for a couple years, but you don't hear about that too often. Obviously, there's retro places around where they just feature these drinks, but there's tons of drinks that were at their time the height of popularity. I'm going to name a couple of them. One is the Harvey Wallbanger. You never hear about that anymore. Its primary ingredient, Harvey Wallbanger, it was a screwdriver with Galliano, kind of like an anisette flavored liqueur. And you see the weird bottle every so often. It tapers. It's a wide bottom, and it kind of curved tapers up, and it's very tall. It goes up to like 20 inches tall. It's a really difficult bottle to put on your shelf in a bar if you have, height restrictions. The Grasshopper, which shows up every so often, I think it's still around because it's the color, it's green. And there's a famous joke with that. I always think it's a famous joke. A bartender is working, and all of a sudden, the Grasshopper walks into the bar, and the bartender goes, "Hey, we got a drink named after you." And the Grasshopper says, "You got a drink named Larry?" Okay, there's another drink is a zombie, which is kind of like a Long Island iced tea. But the thing about it is, the Long Island iced tea, this one has apricot brandy in it and doesn't have tequila and some other ingredients. But the zombie, it was a beginning take on that. So zombie, because you can see the way it's named, that it kind of lends itself to your effect on you because there's so many different boozes in it, stuff like that. A Pimm's Cup, that's from the 1800s. That's from London. It was kind of a fruit cup drink, and it was a brand of gin. So that shows up every so often. People find these old recipes and they stir them up, but to make it into mass cultures, that's not one of them. Oh, this is from the 1920s. It was from a play. It's called Up in Mabel's Room. Up in Mabel's Room. That is a long drink name. You can understand. And then there's one from New Orleans called the Deauville, named after a neighborhood. You don't hear about these drinks anymore. Obviously, regionally, there may be people reviving these drinks, but I'm talking about mass. Where it's popular with the masses. So that's where these were fatty drinks, FADDY. And then there's your classics, the martini, the daiquiri, the margarita, named after Rita Hayworth. I mean, that's how the story's told. And there's tons more. I mean, back they can become a classic, or more recently, like The Cosmopolitan. That was from the 80s, but it's still cranking along. But there's other drinks that kind of like fall by the wayside, because there's certain liquors that come into popularity and then fall out in popularity. There's certain drinks, like the Four Loko. There was a fortified, it's kind of like a malt liquor powered energy drink, which I think is a horrible idea for people. What they need, they don't need alcohol and more energy. Well, yeah, to get these popularities. Oh, Smirnoff Ice. Smirnoff Ice was out there for a little while. I thought they tasted a little like a sweet, bitterly lemon drink. They were popular for a little while, and beers go in and out of style, and then there's classics. But beer itself, as a quaff, as a drink, is definitely a classic. But then there's brands that come in and out as classics. And wine. If you think about it, back in the 80s, I was explaining to the younger bartenders, when you worked or you went out for wine, you had they did have Cabernet. Obviously, Cabernet's been around. But wine wasn't in the 70s. And going into the 80s, wine was slowly making its varietal incursions into the United States. In the United States, it was white wine, red wine. If you think of that Billy Joel song, a bottle of red, a bottle of white, in the scenes from Italian Restaurant. Because that's what you kind of refer to. You say, I'll have red wine, I'll have white wine. They didn't ask for Cabernet, Malbec, Merlot, Zinfandel, red Zinfandel, white Zinfandel. So in the beginning, you would have like a Chablis, a Rosé, and a red Burgundy. And that changed. That changed within 5 years. The Rosé was replaced by white Zinfandel, which is a little sweeter a little sweeter take on that blush wine. But that's American style wine. Because as I've learned through the years that the way we do our wines, instead of more stringent ingredient rules, what we do is we introduce more sugar. And the sugar does something different to the wines that make the taste more consistent, because we look for more mass-produced and less unique vintages. Where in European wines, a lot of European wines, especially the French, their wines have more distinct vintage taste. And that does vary in the United States too. There are vineyards that when they do more specialty vintages that aren't for mass released, they follow more closely the European rules for introducing, you know, the percentage of grapes and things like that. But this show is not about that. We're talking about classic and fats. So when wine was not a big deal in the United States, when you went out for a bottle of wine, they, like I said, they say, well, I want a dry red, I want this. There was Blue Nun. There was one in a bottle that was wrapped in straw. I forget though. There was big bottle. We used to do a lot of big bottle wines. Gallo, just a big jug of red wine. And only wealthy people, the fine wines were the parvenu of wealthy people and the upscale crowd. And it was only in the last, let's say, 30 years that people got more comfortable choosing different wines of different varieties, the Pinot Noir, the Malbec, the Merlot, the Syrah, the Petite Syrah, all those things, and different white wines. And instead of just Chablis, Chardonnay comes into the mix. And then a Pinot Grigio and a Sauvignon Blanc. And then you get your Rieslings, the sweeter ones. Though the sweeter ones came about earlier because that's the way people were with their wines, the masses. And that's where you get classics. But a lot of time, the classics survive from because the upper class always maintains, let's say, a continuity of taste. And I'm not saying great taste, bad taste. They have a continuity of taste. The martini survived so long. If you went to a local blue-collar bar, the martini is not a big drink there. There are people that drink martinis in blue-collar bars. Don't get me wrong. But the martini was generally the you'd see it in the movies at different venues. It was always upper class. It's a remnant. The martini is a remnant of prohibition. It came about 100 years ago, over 100 years ago, 1919, when they passed the law prohibiting the sale of alcohol in the United States. So that was almost like a reset button for us. If the kind of drinks they had, a lot of them were, there was whiskey, gin, not so much vodka back in pre-1920s. Not so much vodka. Vodka was considered more exotic. Rum from the Caribbean, more introduced into the United States, not unusual. Tequila in the Southwest, southwestern part of the United States, but mainly from Mexico. And it was post-World War II or post-Prohibition because it was right when they lifted it in the mid-30s. We're in the middle of the Depression. And it was during World War II where things kind of really exploded across the wine cocktail scene. And people got more creative. Instead of this, a gin, whiskey, you had tequila. Obviously, you had the rum still. And the different rums and all those things. And people were, bartenders were getting more creative with these things. Different drinks. The Pink Lady. You never see the Pink Lady anymore. And there were popular liqueurs that come around. Right now, one of the popular liqueurs, and it has been for about 10 years, 10, 15 years, is Saint Germain, which is an elderflower liqueur. And you see that introduction to it. It's an old liqueur, so I would probably put it in both categories, the fad and the classic. It still remains to be seen if there's classic cocktails that have that. So you have the martini, the margarita, the Cuba Libre. Let's say the White Russian, the Black Russian. I still call them a classic, though. Classic, sometimes you can even go back hundreds of years for some of these. The gimlet. The gimlet, from its humble origins, is just gin and lime juice. But lime juice was reintroduced because of during the British Empire had far-flung territories around the world. So their navy was plying the seas all over the place. And there was a malady that occurred to the sailors, and it was called scurvy, the lack of vitamin C. So they realized that when they drank fruit juices, I don't think they made the connection right away, other than you didn't get scurvy if you drank a lot of fruit juices. So they used lime juice, and they would introduce the lime juice into their with their liquor. They used to get rum. You get rum rations and gin. I guess imagine gin rations too. Why not? And that gin was quickly found that gin and rum go well with lime juice. And that's all you have with a gimlet. So it was just going to happen anyway. The screwdriver, vodka and orange juice, very easy drink, classic because it goes well together. And it was mixed with a screwdriver by construction workers. So it's easy to say when you're looking at drinks, you're making drinks, you people reintroduce once popular cocktails. And it could be popular at your place, but it doesn't become widely popular anyplace else. You still have to be able to make the classics because the classics are something that people are going to be drinking in Miami, in London, in LA, in Tokyo. They're still going to be drinking the gin and tonics. They're going to be drinking the martinis. They're going to be drinking the margaritas, the Manhattans, the old fashioned, all classics. And all widely consumed. And the more unique ones, the fad ones that arise and fall or stay, you know, they could be locally classic, like the locally classic here, the Rum Runner. I wouldn't take anything personal if you're a purveyor of one that makes drinks that aren't widely popular, but are consumed at your place of work because people find them there and say no one else makes them like that, makes those type of drinks. You know? And you're hoping that and maybe you will create a stir and other people will have to start making them. We'll see. But there will always be an argument whether one drink's a fad and another drink's a classic. But the only proof for that in the long run is time. Time tells what something becomes a classic if they're still drinking it years later. This is Jim the Keys Bartender. I'll be back in the second half of the show.